Good afternoon, Your Honors. James Hopkins, representing Christopher Marquez as a defendant in this case. Under 18.1.3406, what does same incident mean? That's what we're here to decide today. Same incident. Crimes arising from the same incident. Now, the Attorney General has basically argued, and I think this term was used a lot at the trial court level, that because we have a crime spree, we have the same incident. Now, a crime spree, Your Honors, is not a legal term. It's a term that's grown from societal use, from use in the media, and it certainly can be a good description of a series of crimes, but a crime spree might describe a pickpocket in the mall who commits numerous crimes in a matter of minutes. It may also be used to describe the actions of something far more serious, like a serial murderer, that may occur over years. So a crime spree does not help us determine whether or not two crimes occurred or arose from the same incident. The case law is actually pretty instructive on this. The case law, cited by both myself and the Attorney General in this case, gives a list of factors that crop up in each one of the cases, the timing of the events, the location, whether the same people were involved aside from the defendant. But what I think is really important is that it's not so much the factors that are making the decision, it's how those factors inform the key determination, which is there a logical nexus between the two crimes or the two events? How can we say they arose from the same incident? Now, one of the cases in particular I think is extremely instructive on this, and that's the Bear case cited by the government. In the Bear case, you have this obvious logical joint between the two crimes or the crimes that were committed. They were committed as a package. The defendant commits one crime, and they commit the next crimes to try to hide their initial crime. It's obvious that there's a logical connection between why those crimes occurred. When you look at them, you can't really argue that they arose from the same incident. However, we have to look at this case and these facts. And how can we say they arose from the same incident? Well, so far all we have is that the crimes involved are described as a crime spree.
Mr. Hopkins, weren't they all committed within approximately 12 hours of each other?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
And if the standard from Beyer, and I think also from Trujillo, is what you're articulating here, who decides whether that's been fulfilled, the trial court or us?
Well, I think the trial court has the discretion to make that determination. But I think what's the issue in this case is that the trial court did not properly carry out the analysis. The trial court basically said this is a crime spree. The trial court didn't have any kind of discussion on what the logical connection was between those cases, aside from the fact that the same defendant was involved in each one of those cases, and they weren't far apart in time.
Well, if Trujillo says a series of acts committed in close proximity, or Beyer says that, or a chain of events forming a part of a schematic whole, is that the appropriate test as you see it?
No, I mean, I think the appropriate test, and I think the common thread that I've seen in all these cases is that the cases are using the factors, which are common in almost every case, time, location, who is involved in the events in question, and they're trying to determine, is there a logical connection?
So my question to you is your argument that the trial court applied an incorrect legal standard, or is your argument that the trial court applied the right standard but just got it wrong?
Well, that's a good question. From my perspective on what the trial court did was they misapplied the standard. They looked at the factors and they thought, well, we have a crime spree and my hands are tied. But they didn't discuss whether or not there was a logical connection between those crimes, whether there was some kind of logical nexus. And I think that has to be done in order to find that crimes arise from the same incident, and it wasn't done in this case. And it was clear the trial court wanted to use its discretion to offer concurrent sentences and felt that it wasn't allowed to. There wasn't actually a lot of discussion about why those incidents were found to arise from the same incident. And I think it's important that the trial court didn't specifically tell us, look, there's a logical connection here, this is what it is. There was obvious that there was a consideration that the cases occurred at a certain time, at different locations, and that there were different people involved in each case. It wasn't obvious why when the trial court saw that it made a determination that they arose from the same incident.
Mr. Hopkins, pardon me for interrupting, but I don't find the phrase logical connection or logical nexus in the cases that are pertinent here. I find phrases such as related group of happenings subordinate to a main plot. And while I certainly don't want to sound like I am quibbling over little, it appears to me that what we ought to be focusing on is the right test. And if the right test is, as is said in Beyer, a related group of happenings subordinate to a main plot, a series of acts committed in close proximity, or a chain of events forming a part of a schematic whole, why don't you address those factors?
Sure.
And why that doesn't fit in your view?
And I agree, Your Honor. I kind of created the term logical nexus because I feel that's what Baer is really talking about. So, you know, what we had here were separate crimes, separate incidents. There's really nothing connecting them except the defendant. If you look at Baer, what you have is crimes that would not have occurred but for the other crimes. And I don't think that that's always as clear in some of the cases that we're looking at, but some of these cases they find that they don't arise from the same incident.
May I interrupt again and ask you this? In the first incident in this case, where Mr. Marquez broke the man's jaw, did he express a desire for anything at that point? Did he want something?
I think there was some evidence, although he was not charged with aggravated robbery, there was some evidence that he was requesting something of value from the gentleman.
What about the other two cases?
There was only one other conviction, and that we're talking about today. There was four incidents that were charged. Two were convicted that led to this sentencing structure. The other one, he was charged with aggravated robbery. So, I mean, it's implied, and I don't recall exactly.
There weren't three confrontations in this case?
I think there was actually four that were charged.
Okay, but ultimately there were convictions coming down on three of them, right? There was the assault, and the menacing,
you're right.
Then a menacing and the aggravated robbery, right?
Right, and only two of them were the crimes of violence.
I understand. But didn't in each case he express a desire to the person he confronted that he wanted something from them?
I think that's a fair assessment.
All right. Tell me why that doesn't suggest that we have a schematic whole and these are just parts of it.
Well, I guess, Your Honor, that, and again, if we're going to say that because one person commits a similar type of crime a number of times, that it's a schematic whole, that's a very loose definition which involves serious implications for the defendant. I mean, that doesn't help us understand how those crimes are connected, aside from the defendant being the person that committed them. I mean, maybe if there was evidence of some kind of overarching purpose for why this particular type of crime was being carried out in close proximity to the other crimes, maybe that would help make the determination, but we don't have that information in this case. All we know is that the crimes occurred within a 12-hour time frame. We don't, there's not evidence that Mr. Marquez had some kind of overarching purpose for committing those crimes. Now, I don't disagree with the court that there did seem to be some similarities in the crimes as far as what was requested, but that doesn't mean that those crimes arose from the same incident. I mean, by definition, they involve different people, different times, different locations. And the two specific crimes that led to the sentencing in this case, the consecutive sentencing, occurred 12 hours apart. And, you know, as far as timing goes, that's something that we don't have a really clear guideline on from some of these cases.
Mr. Hopkins, the sense I get from your argument is that, at least theoretically, you would agree that in some cases, if you had two crimes that were 12 hours apart, they could be part of the same incident. But what your concern is here was that the findings from the trial court were not more specific or more detailed than they were. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, I think that the trial court needed to make a specific finding on why these crimes arose from the same incident. It's basically the trial court just said, well, it's a crime spree. That doesn't mean anything. That doesn't mean the crimes are connected in some way aside from the defendant being involved in each one. And if the court is going to make that determination, it needs to offer that the schematic whole, in the words of Judge Bernard, that should be there for crimes to arise, to be found to arise out of the same incident, and offer these very harsh sentencing guidelines. That didn't happen in this case. Mr. Marquez was sentenced by a judge that didn't want to give him the sentence. The judge felt they had to. And the judge didn't make findings about why the crimes, aside from calling them a crime spree, were a schematic whole. For that reason, Mr. Marquez didn't have the benefit of his judge using discretion like the judge wanted to. And that's the whole of my argument. I think if your honors don't have more questions, I'll reserve the time for rebuttal.
Very well, Mr. Hopkins. You have about 2 minutes and 50 seconds for your rebuttal.
Thank you, your honors.
May it please the court. My name is Ryan Crane, and I represent the people in this matter. My attorney registration number is 37842. I'm going to focus on the defendant's first argument. He actually made three different arguments in his brief, but I'll focus on the first one, although I'm happy to answer any questions the court has about the other two. As the court has already discussed with defense counsel, the defendant's first argument involves what I'll refer to as the mandatory consecutive sentencing provision of the crime of violence statute. Traditionally, and in general, trial courts have discretion whether or not to impose sentences concurrently or consecutively. However, in cases where the defendant is convicted of more than one crime of violence, trial courts must, under this provision, impose the sentences on those crimes consecutively to one another. The question is whether or not those crimes are part of the same incident. If that is the case, and if the trial court so finds, then the trial court must, in that circumstance, impose those sentences consecutively, and the trial court does not have discretion to impose them concurrently, even if it wants to. Four separate published cases from this court have had opportunity to expand on what the term incident means under the statute. The case Bayer was already discussed by this court. Another case, Trujillo in 1992, adopted the same definition, as well as two cases in 2003. The definition of incident, as relevant to this provision of the statute, includes the following definitions: a related group of happenings subordinate to a main plot, as the court alluded to earlier, and also a chain of events forming part of a schematic whole, as the court also noted. What's important here is that the facts of this case comfortably fit within that definition. It is true that the trial court did not go into a lot of detail when articulating why it came to the finding that it did However, the trial court was very certain that these were, in its opinion, after hearing the trial, part of a single incident. Because it made that finding, it found, it concluded that it also did not have discretion in this case to impose the sentences concurrently on the two crime of violence convictions, even if it wanted to. And it was required by statute to impose them consecutively.
Mr. Crane, as I asked Mr. Hopkins about the thrust of his argument, let me ask you a similar question.
Sure.
Wouldn't it be more helpful if the trial court judge had given a more detailed articulation of the reasons for imposing consecutive sentences and saying that there was a single incident here?
It certainly would have been more helpful, and maybe we wouldn't be here. But as this court is very familiar with, trial courts are faced with very heavy dockets. They frequently make findings and articulate as best they can at the time the factors that they need to address, and at times they don't address the factors very specifically, or they address them in a way that makes sense when you're hearing it in person and orally spoken, but on paper makes it difficult to determine exactly what the logical inferences the trial court was relying on. But I agree that that would make this case easier if the court had specifically specifically cited the definition mentioned in these four different cases. What I think is important is that the trial court did reference the statute and did reference and recognize the phrase same incident. And in fact, the parties had briefed the issue below. And so I think it's a fair and important proper inference that this court should make that given the fact that trial court addressed the statutory phrase at issue, had heard the arguments of counsel, and then said, I'm so sure that in this case, these crimes are the same incident, that even if I wanted to impose the sentences concurrently, I cannot because I have made this finding, and the statute requires that I cannot do that.
And could you... If you can...
I apologize that I don't have a printout of the sentencing hearing in front of me. It's a transcript from September 25th, and a couple of different issues were discussed during that sentencing hearing.
Why would the court talk about discretion at all if it found that it had none?
Well, essentially because the court said, if I had my usual discretion to impose sentences on these two crimes, which occurred 12 hours apart, I would probably choose to impose them concurrently in this case. However, I find that these were part of the same incident, and because the crime of violence statute requires me, therefore, to impose such sentences consecutively, I cannot do so. I have no discretion in this case. The crimes at issue here, the court is correct that there were four separate crimes of which the defendant was accused. The defendant was found guilty of three of those crimes. The two of those crimes that were crimes of violence were the two that occurred at the beginning and at the end of this crime spree, as the trial court termed it. They were 12 hours apart. In the first one, the defendant broke a person's jaw in a bar after demanding money or drugs. And in the last incident, or I guess I should say in the last act, it's a good point to demonstrate how fluid the terms are and how important it is to focus on the legal definitions that have been applied by this court. It's very easy, as I think I may have even done in the brief at one point, to slip into saying incident, act, crime spree. And so I think the defendant is making a good point in saying, you know, we throw around these terms sometimes informally, but what's important is that the trial court here did address that this is a statutory term of art, and I'm applying it in this case, and I must determine, therefore, I must impose them consecutively. So, I apologize. The four different acts at issue here, the two of which were crimes of violence, occurred 12 hours apart. The first was the breaking of the man's jaw. The last was the demand for money or valuables with use of a gun. And as the court pointed out, these were part of a schematic whole. They could also be viewed as a group of happenings subordinate to a main plot. And that scheme or that main plot is that the defendant in this case was demanding drugs or money or valuables in each of these four events. If I could have a second. Defense counsel at sentencing referred to these events as I think, said something like they were very drug-related crimes or something like that. I think there was even reference to it in the PSIR, although I can't cite to that, and so I'll just state that without being able to reference a page number. But the idea seemed to be in the record that these were four acts that the defendant committed as part of a attempt to deal with either a drug withdrawal or get a drug fix or something like that. And so, for example, he pulled a gun, well, allegedly pulled a gun and was found guilty of pulling a gun on two different people and demanding $20. In one case, the man said that the gun was 2 inches from his face and the defendant cocked it right before, right after the man said he didn't have a $20 bill on him. And so it makes sense that that's the type of situation we're looking at. Demanding $20 while threatening to kill someone, you would think usually a defendant would be asking for more than just $20 when committing such a serious crime. And so the facts of the case support what defense counsel said at sentencing, that these were drug-related crimes. And I think the record at trial also supported that. If the court doesn't have any further questions, I will thank the courts for its time and ask that the sentence and convictions be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Crane.
Thank you, Judge.
Sir, I don't have anything further at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. Thank you. Again, Mr. Hopkins and Mr. Crane, we appreciate your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.